It's time for the one show that takes you where others won't. Out into the wilderness, past the frontiers of what you thought was possible. With your own personal guide, the Pilgrim, on the 405. Here's Will Crist.
Well, welcome to Pilgrim Talks on this beautiful day here in Laguna Beach. From time to time, we always have great people on. From time to time, we have people who have some particular insights that I've been fascinated with. And Paul David Walker is one who's become a very good friend and has some wonderful insights into how CEOs of major corporations make decisions, how they relate to their people, and how they lead their companies. And I don't want to spend a lot of time introducing Paul, because I think once you get to know him, you hear him a little bit, you'll know why I think he's just a really great guy, tremendous leader, wonderful coach, and stimulating author. So welcome, Paul.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that introduction. I appreciate it.
Sure. Now, you know, Paul, we've talked a lot in small groups and you and me personally about the difference between those businesses who really believe that the most important thing is satisfying the desires, hopes, and dreams of their shareholders, and those leaders who believe otherwise. Talk a little bit about that.
All right. In the 80s, Boone Pickens started stockholder rights movement, and our companies then began to move from long-term thinking to short-term quarterly thinking to appease the stockholders. And it's gotten worse and worse in that regard. You know, I was an officer in a public company, and we had to increase the stock value every quarter, every month. You know, it caused us to do things we might not otherwise do to build a long-term business. So I think that's the essence of the problem we're all faced with, the short-term thinking. And much of that, I believe, has contributed, you know, to the financial crisis we had in 08 and to the fact that, you know, it's slow to recover. It really puts a burden on a leader. You know, people say, well, why isn't a leader more conscious? Why aren't they more long-term? Well, if they were, the board would fire them. Honestly, the stockholders, investors want a return on their money. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's the CEO's job, to get a return on the money. It's a public company. They want to see the stock growing. And there's nothing wrong with that. It just presents a conundrum for building a long-term business.
Do you see any path out of that conundrum?
Well, I think some companies have chosen, you know, not to do earnings calls, some public companies. I think that the path that I would see out of it is getting companies that are more what I would call conscious. Everybody's conscious, of course, but it's a matter of a higher level of consciousness. Like, for example, Patagonia. CEO Casey Sheehan's going to be in my new book, and they're actually a B corporation, a benefits corporation. So they have registered as a company that wants to benefit society as a whole, wants to benefit all stakeholders, not just their investors, but also their employees, and most important, their customers. And I think there are other companies that do similar things, like Whole Foods. They realize that as a company grows, stakeholders, which include the customers and the employees and the investors, all need to benefit. It needs to be a win-win relationship. And it's been shown, you know, we do, you know, my firm does a lot of market research and branding and launch. And it is pretty clear that the younger generation consider companies that do good work, that are socially responsible. They consider them the kind of companies they want to buy for. And if you just take Patagonia as an example, during the depths of the recession, where most clothing sellers and retailers were, you know, their performance was dropping dramatically, Patagonia's performance increased 15% year over year, even during the recession. So it's more or less proven that there's a demand in the market now for more socially conscious leaders and corporations, and the ones that show that seem to be doing better.
Well, I was reading Rolf Jensen's book, The Dream Society, and he's talking about what's coming, and he suggests that fundamental issue about shareholder value being the predominant value up against the values that would include employees as well as customers, looking out for their values as well. He says that's the coming wave. That is coming in the future. He also mentioned, built to last. The companies that stuck with their values, even when they conflicted with creating, higher shareholder value, those companies lasted a lot longer.
Absolutely. I think everybody kind of knows that, but how do you do it? You know, how do you appease your investors when they're, I have a client who has to go unnamed whose board and investors, they want their money. They want to cash out. Stock's not high enough. The board and the investor teams are putting pressure on the CEO to do things that are very short term. You know, it's not going to build the long term viability of the company. And when the CEO explains that, they say, look, you know, your first obligation is to us. And if you can't get the stock up, we'll find somebody who can. Right? And even though this person built the company almost from zero to, $250,000 in revenue, and it's profitable, unless it's not enough. You know, we're in this cycle of more, more, more. So it's tough.
Think about that, Paul. That's not just them, is it? I mean, a big chunk of investment in this country comes from pension funds, right?
Well, that's
true. And that's us. That's us. If our pension fund is not performing, we're going to be looking for another one, right?
Yep, that's right.
So it's not just a them. It seems to me it's the culture of our country right now.
Yeah, it seems like I was just talking to my wife, and she was just having her pedicure or manicure. I'm going to a high school class reunion in the morning. And this lady who was doing the work has been in the country for 14 years, and her husband's out of work now. And so she has no health insurance, so she was very concerned. And she was saying to my wife that in the last 14 years, she's seen a real shift in people's attitudes in general. The level of fear is so high. And she has noticed a distinct difference over the last 14 years because there she is giving manicures and pedicures. So she's a good indicator of how people are feeling. And, of course, she works in Southern California, which is one of the wealthier parts of the country. So, and when you look at the media, there's so much fear rolled out day after day after day. If you look at the statistics on crime since the 60s, the overall violent crime rate has gone down 37% since the 60s. Very significant improvement. And yet the overall reporting of violent crime has gone up 400%.
Yeah, I was looking in the newspaper the other day. I mean, I think it was the OC Register. It could easily be LA Times. And every page had a report of murder from someplace. It was either a local or foreign. A local or national or foreign. It's almost as if they have to fill a column inches with violence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you're creating fear. So when people are fearful, they go into a form of fight or flight, which is natural. It's a natural response. When you're in fear, you go into fight or flight. The blood runs from your internal organs in your brain to your arms and legs to facilitate running or fighting. And that is sort of designed for, maybe a once a quarter incident when you run into a wild animal or something. But now, because of the fear being projected everywhere as a method to sell things, people are in this state quite often, and this is why you have such problems with indigestion, heart conditions. Your internal organs are being depleted of the blood they need to operate properly, and people's brains are not working as well. They're very narrow. When you're in fight or flight, what happens to your brain, it narrows your consciousness so that you can concentrate on the threat and do something about it. And that's fine when you're in a fight, right?
Sends it all, when you're sends in a the fight, blood back right? to the amygdala, doesn't it?
Yeah, yes. But it doesn't work for innovation, doesn't work for creativity, it doesn't work for people's peace of mind, and it is so taxing on the body and the psyche. So
I got an idea. Have you been aware of during this rhetorical battle for the presidency? You've been aware of the fact checking group, haven't you?
Oh, sure.
Well, right. There was a petition that came around, on the internet. I don't think they were particularly partisan, but the petition, I think they got a couple hundred thousand names on it. The petition was to have fact checkers at the debates so that they could immediately point out, things that were not true. I guess that's a nice word for lies, but not true. Now, it just occurs to me, what if we spoke with the newspapers and the media, and we said, look, we want you to have at least 50% of neutral news, if not good news, up against the 50% that, you might have of all the violence. And we monitored that. I mean, that would be a way of at least becoming aware of what we are doing to ourselves and recognizing that there are choices.
Yeah, but they're in the same place as our CEOs. Ugliness, violence seems to sell. Are they supposed to do something that doesn't sell? I mean, that's the conundrum, if you will, right? It sells. It sells.
Yeah, if it leads.
Went to All Good News, I think you look at something like the Christian Science Monitor, and that's pretty bad. But, they don't get the kind of ad, they don't get the kind of notoriety that the other papers get that are full of a lot of sensationalism.
Well,
it's a societal issue as much as, you try to blame the corporations, blame the government. We have enormous challenge ahead of us to really shift the way we're operating as a society. It's a huge challenge, and I would like to see more politicians and leaders in our society talk about this whole notion of fear and fear-based discussions. I mean, I dare say, it is probably the biggest problem we have. Unvalidated fear. People who are in the media or on the media, and I don't mean the reporters as much, because I think the various media sources are all pretty clear about, you got Fox, it's clear about their, what they call a conservative agenda. I don't agree that they're conservative at all, but that's another conversation. And MSNBC, which is a more liberal, and then you got CNN in the middle, and they're all clear. You can't blame the media. They all have a methodology. CNN always shows 3 points of view, so we can't blame.
Well, but all of the media are owned by major corporations who are public companies.
That's right, and they have to sell. They have to get advertising, and they have to get viewership. And so they've all found their little niche of viewers, and it's very tribal. I have my conservative friends, and I have my liberal friends. Neither one of them really are interested in the facts. They're just trying to promote tribe, their point of view. And, we're in a massive, they say it's the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. I got a flash for you. It's the worst financial crisis, period. It's going to get worse as time goes on. It is very serious. I was talking to a guy who has a way of calculating global asset base. Right. And, he measures things like oil in the ground, buildings, real estate, he has this whole thing. But basically what he said is our debt levels globally have way exceeded the asset base economic. So when your debt ratio are way higher than your asset base and assets are going down because of the recession and because of all the other things that are going on, that asset base is going to be valued, every quarter. And yet our debt levels are going up every quarter in almost every arena, except the banks. They've been forced to put money aside now, so we don't have to bail them out again.
Well, that's an interesting concept when you think about it. I mean, we can have cities in California going bankrupt. We could contemplate California going bankrupt. We've talked about, the consequences of the United States even thinking about not raising the debt ceiling. Can you think about the world going bankrupt?
Yeah, well, it happened in the 30s. That's what happened. The Roman Empire fell. There was no rule of law. The wealthy who hoarded their money and, you know, tried to enslave around them, and not because they were evil, just because there was no rule of law and they were frightened, and put a long time before the Renaissance sort of pulled, mm-hmm. you know, the world out of situation. If you go back over history, you know, the Roman Empire was a great empire, but there were empires before that. And after that, the British Empire. What happened to the British Empire? They extended their credit way beyond their ability to earn, way beyond their asset base. They extended their military beyond its ability to effectively, you know, be pushed. And that empire fell apart. Same thing happened to the Soviet Union, right?
Mm-hmm.
Put most of their capital into selling arms, trying to convert countries over to communism, trying to compete with us. Race and the nuclear arms race, and so they exceeded their, you know, debt to asset ratios fell apart and it collapsed suddenly because we outspent them.
Yeah, right.
We had a better economy. We outspent them.
Now, what are you thinking? It's our turn.
Well, it sure looks that way, doesn't it? And here's one of my pet peeves. You tell me if I'm getting off topic here, but you know, you hear politicians. Mostly conservative politicians, but even Democrats, say, well, we got to get back to the way we were. We got to get back to when things were working. We got to go back and, you know, rediscover, reclaim America, all this. Now, okay, it sure was better in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, right? Here's why it was better. World War II destroyed Asia, China, Japan, Korea, also destroyed all of Europe, destroyed Europe's economy. At the end of World War II, up until the mid-90s, we had no global competition. It was easy to win. Now we have aggressive global competition. China, India, Brazil, South America, whereas Europe's having some financial problems, but they have great infrastructure, both social infrastructure, physical infrastructure. If you've ever been to Europe, you've driven around the UK, the roads, the bridges, everything is very, very well maintained. Their social systems, you might argue, well, it's socialism, you know, whatever. All their people are insured. Nobody has to worry about health care. Nobody has to worry about the rule of law. You know, they have a very up-to-date infrastructure. China is building brand new infrastructure. It's all beautiful. Ours is crumbling. We haven't invested in it. Asia and Europe are all investing heavily in education and developing their people. In India, we're cutting our investment in education. All our competitors are spending more on R&D than we are. We're cutting R&D. So where we are as a nation is we're kind of used to not having competitors. We're used to being the big dog and being able to get away with about whatever we want to do. I'm not trying to diminish all we've accomplished. But we have to recognize we've accomplished this in an environment where we didn't have any competition. And now we have aggressive competition. Aggressive. And Asia has lower wage rates, which is very hard to compete with, but it can be done. Germany has some of the highest wage rates in the world, and yet their economy is so strong it's literally supporting all of Europe.
I get the sense that there's a similarity in the dynamic to a company's sales team that, you know, for years just had to be order takers.
That's right.
And now they have to, there's no more order taking. If they're not out prospecting, that phone's not going to ring. If they don't have some way of getting in front of people who believe that this company can solve the problems that they have, they're not going to have people looking around. They're not going to have people just kind of calling to find out what's happening. Is that you've got the internet, you've got all sorts of anonymous ways of collecting information. And mm-hmm. without a very assertive sales team, which understands that their job is to find those people, to get invited in, you know, your company's not going to survive. It sounds to me like it's very similar, that our general economy is very similar. We've moved from a place where what we thought was competition was very little competition to a place where we've got very aggressive competitors.
Hungry, aggressive competition.
And yeah. It's not going to get any better, is it, with the population increase?
Well, our population is not growing that much, but...
No, not ours, but I mean the global competition.
Yeah, global competition.
Global population.
Sure. So we forgot to
mention 9 billion.
Yeah, and I forgot to mention, you know, a lot of the Middle Eastern countries with oil and so on. They're, you know, Saudis reinvesting their money into infrastructure and all kinds of programs. So they're investing in our countries and all around the world. So a little different than China and India and Europe, but nonetheless, it's just another competitive group that we're fighting with. And you know what you bring up about salespeople, I have a client who's their top sales guy doesn't make sales calls. He's kind of living off all his old customers. Mm-hmm. And yet he's booking more than anyone else, but you know he doesn't like to leave his house, so he doesn't go out and bring in new customers. Somebody else has to do that. What you say is true. People get complacent. They sit around saying, oh, well, this is the greatest country in the world. It's nice to say. It's nice to be patriotic. I love the country. I love living here. But you got to look at the facts. You know, many indicators. We're lagging behind other highly industrialized countries. Many indicators. And it's not unpatriotic to point that out. It is patriotic because, you know, we got to do something about it.
Yes.
And,
well,
and
listen,
you can't solve a problem. There's two things. One, you can't solve a problem until you know what it is, first of all.
Yeah.
Right? That's basic science, right? Right? And second of all, Einstein, my favorite quote, is you can't solve a problem at the same level of thinking that created the problem. And where we're at as a culture is we need to acknowledge reality. And
yep. We
don't want to do that. And that shows up at every level in our culture. Every level. People still, now, you know, housing's getting a little better. People are going to start leveraging their mortgages, you know. That's what caused the problem in the first place is the fact that I had a client in the subprime mortgage business, and they used to go back to their clients every year, reevaluate the value of the home, which had gone up, and then lend them some more money so they could buy, you know, skidoos and boats and motorhomes and new cars and all of that.
Right.
And,
yep.
And then I'm sitting in the guy's office, and he gets a call from one of the big investment banks, and the guy's beating him up. He says, I want more mortgages. You're not sending me enough mortgages. Send me more mortgages or you're done, right? I mean, so he had to, you know, so he's pushing his people, you know, get some more mortgages. So,
amazing.
You know, it's not anybody's fault. You know, if you look at the two political parties, you can say, well, the Republicans took the teeth out of the regulations and pulled a lot of regulations and went into this lazy fair trickle-down stuff, and it just didn't work. Okay. So then you could say, well, the Democrats are over-regulating everything. You know, they're creating too big of a government, too big of a bureaucracy. Although, but that's not the answer either, you know. You can't play a game, you know. Like, I think the NFL, you know, problems with the referees right now, but in general, is one of the most robust sports organizations in the world. And, you know, they are very, very centralized. They have a planned league that makes sure that every team in every city can have a team who could win the Super Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
And there are rules. You know, when you play football, you're out of bounds if you step across the line. There are rules. And that makes the game better, not worse.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't want regulation, if you don't want any central government, move to Somalia, for Christ's sake. It would be heaven for you. It would be heaven for you. Right? So, I mean, right, neither side has got it figured out. The problem
that's right.
We have
that's
is
right.
We,
well, listen, I want to talk a little bit more about that awareness idea. Can you stick around after the break?
Yep.
We'll be right back after we hear a word from our sponsors.
I'm Al Strauss with Sandler Training. Talk to you about rule number 38. The problem the prospect brings you is never the real problem. When people have heard this rule and thought about it a bit, if they've been in sales for more than a few months, they almost always say, Well, that's obvious. I've had lots and lots of prospects that told me what they wanted. I showed them what they wanted, and they didn't buy it. So it seems that it would be obvious. The problem is, most folks don't understand it, and you get in the middle of the conversation, and here's a prospect who's interested in something, you've got the something, and you just show up. And what you really need to learn how to do is ask a bunch more questions, because frankly, in most cases, the prospect doesn't even understand what the real problem is. And so if you ask three or four more questions about what they claim they need or are looking for or want, you're going to discover that it morphs, it changes, sometimes dramatically. What they end up needing is perhaps even diametrically opposed to what they originally said they were looking for. So ask the questions, don't take the first thing they give you, dive down into the real issues, and you're going to have yourself a much better day selling to this prospect.
And now back to Will and his guest.
Well, we've been talking with Paul David Walker, author, coach, and leadership consultant. Paul, you know, it seems to me that the things we're talking about, number one, is I'm coming to believe that we're not in a normal cycle. We're not, this is not like on the beach where the wave comes out and the wave comes back in. It seems to me that we're in a very significant change in the way we're doing business. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. We're really at a turning point as a country and as the world, for that matter. It's at a turning point. And it's not, you know, it's not a blip. It's very serious. And the problem, you know, at least here in the United States, I can't speak that much about Europe, although I've been studying it, is we're frozen. We can't do anything. Our country is so polarized that neither party is able to get anything through Congress, not able to do anything. And so it's getting worse and worse and worse. We're borrowing more money. Our government's borrowing more money, right? Corporations are not investing in the future. They're holding back. We're frozen. And
it seems to me that rather than that being the problem, it seems to me that's the symptom of the change. Because where before, when I read history, you know, our history, the last 50 years, there was a sense of, well, okay, so the Democrats control it this time and they'll move it in a direction. Then the Republicans control it and they'll move it in this direction. And it kind of moved back and forth. And there was never a final decision about it. And now the paralysis seems to me to be the signal that we are in a significant change about how we're going to be doing it. Things are going to come to a head, and it's not going to be one side winning. It's going to be sides losing, not knowing what to do. And then that's the next question. You know, I mean, right now it's the awareness. And I'm not sure that we have a common awareness of the dilemma that we're in as a country. That we're not. I'm not sure that we... I'm pretty sure we don't have a common awareness about the perils that we have, and that this paralysis is really a symptom. It's not just a state of affairs. It's a symptom of the end of an old way of doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Just like the seeing the shareholder value as the most important, we can't continue to do that. That won't work. And that kind of dilemma that you talk about is a symptom of something coming to an end.
Yeah. Well, the one thing I can tell you is coming to an end is the free ride we have had as a nation. That's coming to an end, big time. And we've got to do something about it. Now, capitalism is the best system ever. And, you know, free enterprise has created untold wealth.
Mm-hmm.
But it started in the U.S. when we had no competition. And now we have competition, and our competitors are using capitalism, using free market dynamics, but they're doing it a little differently. There's a partnership between the government and business. I was talking to one of my friends at Toyota. We were having lunch. He's one of the executives. And he was complaining to me when Obama held out just orders, Chrysler, and he was, you know, it just changes the whole competitive landscape. Government is helping an auto company, you know, and it took all my self-control not to start laughing out loud. And I said, the Japanese government has been helping their corporations since World War II. What the hell are you talking about? Unfair.
Yeah. Right. Right. Right.
So I think that's the one thing that has to change, is our companies and our government have to cooperate with each other.
Mm-hmm. Well, but we all have to cooperate with each other. Isn't that... That's what I'm thinking. That's one of the elements of the change that's coming. We seem to have believed that somehow, by misunderstanding Darwin or thinking that Darwin was really us, this whole notion of competition, that, you know, social Darwinism is in the same thing as capitalism. And it's not. Capitalism can work with cooperation.
Well, capitalism is cooperation. I mean,
There's lots of people that seem to believe that it's a competitive, strongest one wins, and if you're not competitive, you're going to die. And I just don't Darwin that, and I don't think that's true.
Well, first of all, Darwin's theory was not survival of the fittest; mm-hmm. It was survival of the fit.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, what he said is, and any gardener knows this: if you have a plant that needs a lot of sun, and you plant it in the sun, it's going to thrive. Plant it in the shade, it's not. That's evolution, right? So the seed falls in a place where there's not enough water, it's going to die. It falls in a place where there's plenty of water, it's going to thrive. Survival of the fit. That's what Darwin was talking about. It wasn't survival of the fittest. It wasn't, you know, reinforcing, you know, our tribal beliefs that has driven humanity since, you know, beginning time. A good company, you know, I'm advising them all the time, it's a team sport. You have to get your team cooperating with each other. And then you have to synchronize that cooperation with your customers and the market potential. It's a collaborative process to build a successful company. I don't know how many CEOs I've had to say, did you realize that John Wayne didn't actually do all those things you saw in the movies? He's an actor. Sorry. Good entertainment, but that ain't the way the world works.
That's right. That's right.
You know.
Well, I think that's what I think is that to me is a symbol, Paul, of the end that we're coming to. We're coming to the end of the time where it's us against them. I mean, when you talk about the global implications, we're coming to a time when we're going to have to all cooperate, and that goes beyond a nation state.
That's true. Yeah, absolutely.
And we may have to go bankrupt to do it.
Well, I hope not, but that may be the case. There's certainly, it's in no one's interest to have the United States go bankrupt.
I don't mean us as a country. I'm talking about the world. I mean, you know, sometimes, well, I'll tell you what I tell my people in training. When I talk to them, we talk a lot about people who live on that river in Egypt.
Yeah, denial.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, that came from AA. And how do people in denial, we know from AA that there's some people that have to come to the very bottom, the mm-hmm. very bottom to actually come out of denial. And, you know, maybe that's where we're going is, we're going to have to wake up at some point and change, because this is not the last man standing wins. Because there's no winning if you're the only one standing in this world.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, we have a provocative cultural paradigm that is not based on, is not prepared for the future, I believe. So I call it the when you wish upon a star syndrome.
Right? Tell us about your book. What have you found by interviewing these significant CEOs out there?
Okay, I've interviewed about 26 CEOs of successful companies, and the first thing that you must master is knowing when you know. Knowing when you know the answer to any problem, any strategy, any set of market demands and wants. The greatest leaders spend most of their time figuring out what is the right answer to this problem, and they do that with a high level of openness, a high level of curiosity, and they are not locked into what worked in the past. That is step one. That is so important. And a good leader in a good corporation is not going to be in denial. Right? Mm-hmm. Then, of course, what everyone says is, once you do that, so now you know the answer, you've got to paint this compelling picture of that answer that inspires people, that creates clarity, that creates focus. And everyone that I've talked to has various ways of doing that, and some are more effective than others, of course, but the ones that are the most effective, that picture permeates every level of their organization, down to the janitor, permeates the marketplace, huge way, the picture of the value that this product brings. Apple's a great example. Now they've gone from not even being in the game to the biggest company in the world. Masters at marketing, masters at painting the picture. Step three, build commitment. Just because you paint a great, compelling picture, you need to check in and figure out if people are getting it, if it's coming through, if people are committed. You have to get your people committed to do everything it takes, you know, to make that picture, that economic reality, it comes from the strategic plan, reality, and everybody has to be committed, starting with yourself as the CEO and your executive team and all your employees, and then the market. You know, you've got to get your market committed. You've got to get your vendors committed. Everybody has to get committed to the new strategy, the new vision, the new picture. And then, of course, acknowledging reality, you know, which you have to live in the present. I was talking to a business leader, and she has all kinds of feuds going on with people in her community and so on. And I said to her, I said, you know, your responses are based on the past. The way you're operating, you got burned, this happened to you, that happened to you. You're responding based on the past. And the past is just a memory. Past is a collection of thoughts and beliefs you put in your brain and think are real. And they're not. Nobody's that perceptive. No situation you were in the past were you able to perceive all the dynamics. Human perception is not that good, and thought itself is not able to capture all of that. You must be completely present. You must deal with present moment. The only portal to the future is through the present moment, because that's the only thing that is real. Your memories about the past, even detailed history that we all study, is still an approximation of what happened. What happened is way more complicated than anybody can chronicle. You've got to be present. You've got to be in the moment. And then lastly, you have to have, if you're a leader of a corporation or a leader of your family or a leader of any kind, you have to have a level of inner stillness. My favorite example is a hurricane. The stiller the eye, the more powerful the storm. And when the eye breaks up, the storm breaks up. When the stillness breaks up, the power breaks up. Great leader and a great corporation. The great corporations who are aligned around their vision and their strategy and their values, there's very much stillness in the company. People are not gossiping. People are not wondering what the right path is. People are not in conflict. One of the people I interviewed for the book said, it was a female leader, she says, I want a no-drama corporate culture. I want to be focused on our business. I don't want to have a lot of internal drama. And likewise, if you do the first four steps that I just discussed, you're pretty certain about the direction. You're pretty certain about what has to be done. So you have an internal stillness in your head. You're not doubting yourself. You're not wondering. You're not going, oh, geez, what, you know, I don't know if it's right. And then that permeates down through the company. You know, if you're not sure, if your team is debating, if you have tribal warfare in the company, there's no stillness. There's no purpose. You're weak.
That would mean that the leader, the CEO, has to have no fear, right? It's not, I'm not talking about being fearless in the sense of denying that I'm fear. I'm just going to power through this. I mean, we talked about that in the very beginning of our conversation tonight. They have to be in a place where they're not afraid.
Yeah, and if you do your homework, you're not.
Uh-huh.
Right? So fear is good. If you're on the wrong track, it's a feedback mechanism going, hey, things are not working. That's where mm-hmm. denial comes in. Well, I'm going to deny it.
Mm-hmm.
But the clarity comes from doing your homework, knowing the answer, doing the research, knowing that this is right, knowing there's a need, and painting the compelling picture, building commitment, acknowledging and responding, not reacting, to reality.
Mm-hmm.
That creates a certain confidence, a certain inner stillness. And if you don't have the inner stillness, you need to start over again. Is this the right answer? Is this the right direction? Have I painted the picture clearly? And how you find out is you talk to people and see how committed they are. And then, you know, so it's a sensorial process. And the more you know, the more clear the picture is, the more you deal with present reality and build commitment, the more inner stillness, the more power you and your company has. Same is true for a salesperson. If you know your product and believe in your product, you don't have to lie. You don't have to exaggerate. You don't have to manipulate. You know it's good. You just have to learn how to paint the picture of why it's good for them. You have to learn to build commitment, transfer the commitment you have to your client. And you have to deal, you know, I listened to your commercial. You know, the presenting symptom is generally not the correct symptom. You know, the mm-hmm. problem is generally not the correct problem, right?
Right. Right, right.
Right? But if you've done your homework, you know the answer. So it's just a matter of communicating and getting, you know, the client to see that answer.
Can we generalize that to, our economy, our region, California, the country? Can we generalize that in terms of, you know, for instance, take violence on in the media? If can we get really clear about the kind of world we want to live in and then get really clear about what, in fact, is there? I mean, like you and I were pointing out, we don't live in a violent culture these days.
We don't.
Relative to 20 years ago.
One of the safest places in the world to live.
What's that?
It's one of the safest places in the world to live outside
yeah.
of Europe and
yeah.
Canada.
Yeah.
And yet, the picture we paint is that it's dangerous living in America.
Yeah.
My relatives in England wonder why the hell we live over here with all the violence and the guns and all of that.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And that's the anomaly. I mean, that's the aberration. That's not. I mean, when was the last time that you had gunshots on your street?
Yeah, I've never.
Never. I mean, you know, and the reality is for most of the people in America, that's the case.
That's right. So yes, you can, you know, as a nation, as a state, as a city, the clearer the picture, the more committed the people are, the more successful society is going to be. I think Oklahoma City is going through a renaissance, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the city's kind of rallied behind a lot of things mm-hmm. that they all think are important to grow the city. You know, the basketball team did well. And, you know, if you've been to Oklahoma City, it's not a pretty place, but it's getting prettier all the time, right?
That's right.
Because,
that's right.
You know, people are committed to
that's
making
right.
the city great. It's that simple. It's not.
Well, that's what I grew up with in South Texas. I mean, we had, you know, 20 or 30 small towns, all of them under 20,000 population back in 1965 when I was graduating from high school. And it was the business people, well, along with the educators and along with the professional people, they decided what kind of social world they wanted to live in. And when they didn't have the college that they wanted, they got on the bus. And they didn't hire lobbyists. They got on the bus and went to Austin and lobbied themselves. And they didn't call it lobbying. They called going up and talking to their representatives. When they wanted more jobs for people in the town and realized that's how they built the tax base, they went and found Hager Slacks and did what they needed to do to get that Hager Slacks plant in Edinburgh. And you know, I'm with Jim Collins, you know, Jim Clifton in his book Coming Jobs War. He has the same kind of picture that you and I have, that, you know, it's dangerous out there economically. And we're going to need to create a lot of jobs. But by the end of the book, he's saying, but we in this country are, you know, we can do it and we will. And I just think that part of what that's going to mean is becoming aware of, what it's going to take and going out and doing it.
Yeah, and it's sad because we all know what it's going to take.
Yeah.
It's going to take pulling together, cooperating with one another, solving our problems one at a time, and being committed to it. We all know that, but we somehow have gotten to a point where, you know, it's complicated, of course, where we can't do anything. We can't pull ourselves together as a country. We're too divided. And
yeah.
This is dangerous when you have competitors.
Yeah, that's right.
It'd be right. Like me coming into a company.
The door, that's not the time to be having a family squabble.
That's right. That is not the time. And probably what the most common thing I do with a company is I find there's tribal warfare going on internally.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I help them, the leadership, pull the whole company together around the vision, mission, and strategy.
Uh-huh.
And it's miraculous, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, a company's smaller than a nation, right? But the principles are the same.
Yeah. Well, it's all fractal. I mean, it is the same. It's the same whether you're working with a family or you're working with, a one-on-one counseling client. It's all the same. If you got a war going on, you're not going to be very creative. You're certainly not going to be able to commit yourself to accomplishing great things. And you first have to align and get out of the war, get clear about what you want to go, and I'd follow you. Get very clear about what the reality is and get committed to what steps you're going to take.
Yeah. I always say, hey, what would happen to the Lakers if Kobe Bryant blocked Paul Gasol's shot? What would happen to Kobe Bryant? Timeout would be called. The coach would be screaming at him and put him on the bench and say, you know,
uh-huh.
He's off the team, for Christ's
sake. Yeah,
sakes.
Yeah.
But we block each other's shot all the time.
Oh, that's, yeah, yeah, yeah.
When we're on the same team.
That's right. That's right. Well, listen, Paul, this has been wonderful. It's been very innovating and stimulating. Tell us a little bit about, as we come in here, tell us about the book you've got in print now and how we can get it, and tell us a little bit about the book that's coming and when it's coming out.
All right. So the new book called Invent Your Future, which is based on interviews with approximately 26 successful CEOs like Casey Sheehan, CEO of California Pizza Kitchen, and a number of others. And one CEO runs a company that actually invents products, so he knows how to invent the future.
Mm-hmm.
That's coming out in the spring. My existing book is called Unleashing Genius, Leading Yourself, Teams, and Corporations. Unleashing Genius. And you can get that on Amazon. And the theme of that book is first step, when you're building a team of people, is to find people's natural gifts, natural genius, and unleash that. And then synchronize everybody on the team around everyone's individual genius. And then look at your business to find the natural genius of your business. And the natural genius of the business is the aggregate of individual genius, team genius, and what's going on in the marketplace. So this is a great book, Unleashing Genius, for anyone. A great book for if you have a young son or daughter who's just starting out in the world. If you can get them to read this, this comes from my work with CEOs. Over the last 28 years, as well as the interviews that I'm doing for the new book. But these are the things that work. This is not a consultant's book. This is a real book. I'm a writer, and it's gotten great reviews. So get your listeners to buy it.
Wonderful. So glad that you appreciate taking time to be with us today, Paul. Looking forward to our next time to be together.
Well, thanks for having me on, and make it a great day.
Yeah, and you have a good time at Michigan for your high school reunion, huh?
It'll be fun.
There you go. All right. Take care. So there we have it. Paul David Walker, local author, coach, and leadership consultant extraordinaire. Wonderful people we have here in Orange County. Just tremendous. Creative, competent, and certainly take a hard look at where we are and what we need to be doing to strengthen the economy, take care of each other, become more compassionate and collaborative, and more innovative as we move forward into this wonderful new world. So that's it for the Pilgrim Pilgrim on the 405 this week. We look forward to talking with you next week. We'll be talking to the director of a very innovative group out at California Baptist University, David Poole, who's going to be talking about how they're hiring all of these people out there. Goodness, I thought we had no companies that were hiring. And then I found out that Dave Poole has been hiring 15, 20 people for a brand new program out there. Look forward to talking with you then. So this is the Pilgrim on the 405 saying, make it a great day.
You've been listening to the one show that takes you where others won't. Out into the wilderness, past the frontiers of what you thought was possible, with your own personal Pilgrim on the 405.